Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 630, titled Partying Like It's 1929. This has been recorded on March 23rd of the year 2008. Before we get into the meat of the broadcast, as always, let me remind / inform listeners that if you're only listening to the program, whether it's online or whether it's live on one of the stations that carries it, you're missing the better part of the For the Record experience. www.spitfirelist.com and other broadcasts, or other websites rather, linked to that, contain a wealth of information. Spitfirelist.com has an entire mini library of anti-fascist books, long article-length descriptions of the programs, the last four or so For the Record shows available for download for free. Lectures are available for download for free. And in the For the Record blog sphere and also the FTR supplemental section, you can read many of the articles that I use on the programs in their entirety. Also, book excerpts are available there. And, of course, the linked websites maintained by Heroic Sister Station WFMU-FM contain a vast amount of audio information. So please use the websites. And in particular, if some of the things that I say sound strange or if it's a little bit too pedantic a format for your taste, and I can certainly appreciate that, I think you'll find that a lot of the questions that you have or disagreements, problems of one kind, will be illuminated, if not eliminated, by using the websites and checking out the source material at length and in detail, okay? Alrighty, well, this is Easter Sunday. It is when Christians celebrate the resurrection of Jesus from the grave. Somebody who doesn't figure to undergo a political resurrection anytime soon is former New York State Governor Eliot Spitzer, who won a reputation and a well-deserved reputation as a gadfly for crooked corporate interests, and in particular was something of a consistent opponent, a true watchdog to maintain and in cases prosecute, maintain a vigil on and when necessary prosecute some of the malefactors of what Teddy Roosevelt referred to as the malefactors of great wealth. That will no longer be taking place because Eliot Spitzer, for all of his integrity in the political field, turned out to be personally stupid, a la Bill Clinton, and got himself stung using an escort service. It's also interesting to note, and although we're not going to harp on this aspect of Spitzer's demise, it's interesting to note that the thousands of dollars that he used for his high-price hooker basically got him on the terror watch list for, you know, making cash transactions in the many thousands of dollars. And so ultimately it was the counter-terror and the anti-terror financing statutes that led to his demise. Funny, but it didn't lead to the fulfillment of the prosecution of the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. I'm wondering if that might have had something to do with the fact that among the elements that were uncovered, there were elements leading directly to the core of not only the Republican Party, but the Bush administration. And I wonder if that had something to do with the fact that Talat Altman, a director of Harkin Energy, a longtime personal friend and political advisor for both Georges Bush and a man who gave a Muslim benediction at the 2000 Republican convention, interceded personally with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill on behalf of the institutions and individuals targeted by Operation Green Quest. Paul O'Neill was then forced out of office some 6-7 months later. He now occupies the same political turf as Eliot Spitzer, not disgraced, but gone, if not forgotten. We're going to take a look at the demise of Eliot Spitzer, which, interestingly enough, takes place as the malefactors of great wealth and all of the now you see it, now you don't, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat. People on Wall Street are, well, let's just say that what they've done is manifesting itself in big time, as Dick Cheney would say, and who knows exactly where that's going to lead. But just when we could use somebody like Eliot Spitzer self-destructs because of the fire down below, so to speak. And that is most unfortunate. It remains to be seen whether that was truly just capricious or was there a method to this particular madness. And I also don't want to be misunderstood as trying to gloss over the stupidity of Eliot Spitzer under the circumstances, or perhaps it's just the willful blindness. One would think that someone of his relative sophistication would be aware that the big boys would be targeting him, and you don't go messing with some of the people he's messed with and not engender a desire for revenge. But I could care less if he patronized a hooker. I think this may not sit well with some of the Christians in the audience, but I think prostitution should be legalized. It should be taxed. The ladies involved should get regular medical care and take it out of the criminal realm. It's just not something that I think should be a criminal offense. And I think we could not only take a bite out of organized crime, so to speak, but generate needed revenues and pull this whole sorry business out of the twilight in which it does not belong and treat it sort of the way the Germans do. Prostitution is legal in Germany, and I think it should be legal here. Nonetheless, it isn't, and sure as bloody hell won't be anytime soon. And Elliot Spitzer should have known that the knives would be sharpened for him. And among the people who may have been sharpening those knives was none other than GOP operative Roger Stone. In the past, we've dealt with Roger Stone. Roger Stone was one of the top people behind, of all people, Al Sharpton. Now, Al Sharpton is a Democrat. He also is an African-American. He also has been found to be quite abrasive by some people. And when we dealt with Roger Stone, and the program in which that is annotated will be noted in the future, or it will be noted in the description for this broadcast, I should say, one of the hypotheses that I entertained in connection with Roger Stone being one of the driving forces behind Al Sharpton's political career was that perhaps Roger Stone was looking to fragment the Democrats or perhaps even discredit them by having someone as, shall we say, indiscreet as Al Sharpton, sort of being the spear carrier for African Americans and the champion of African Americans being a primary element of the Democratic Party. But anyway, Elliot Spitzer has gone down. Was it Roger Stone who helped to bring him down? That is the focal point of a column by Robert Novak, and it was discussed in the Raw Story blog, and we're going to read part of that. This is from March 17th of 2008. Intrigue. Novak suggests GOP operative behind Spitzer fall. It reads in part, was a political operative behind the fall of New York Governor Elliot Spitzer? That's a suggestion in a Sunday column by conservative columnist Robert Novak. A Republican operative, he's found, predicted the governor's fall specifically several months in advance. Quote, Republican political operative Roger Stone, Elliot Spitzer's longtime antagonist, predicted his political demise more than 3 months in advance, Novak writes. Spitzer's entrapment by federal authorities investigating a prostitution ring raised speculation that Stone, with a 40-year record as a political hitman, somehow is behind it, unquote. Elliot Spitzer will not serve out his term as governor of the state of New York, unquote, Stone said December 6th on Michael Smirkanish's radio talk show, Novak added. He gave no details, unquote. Novak's post was titled GOP Strategists at Work, unquote. In an interview last fall, Stone cheered the governor's demise and hinted further that he'd known about the governor's fall. I didn't make him go to a prostitution ring, Stone told a Newsday columnist March 12th. He did that all on his own, unquote. Asked whether he had a hand in Spitzer's woes, Stone said, quote, no comment, unquote. I will say I knew it was coming, he added. That's why I wasn't too upset about the results of the special election, unquote, where a Democrat won control of a formerly Republican seat in the state Senate, where the Republicans have a one-vote margin. Speaking of the scandal, Stone added cryptically, my work isn't done there, just watch, unquote. Stone now runs an anti-Clinton political 527 group, Citizens United Not Timid, the acronym of which has sparked fury among liberal groups. Quote, there is no hard evidence that Elliot Spitzer was targeted for investigation, but the story of how he was caught does not ring entirely true to many experienced former prosecutors and current criminal lawyers, unquote, Dershowitz wrote, again quoting, the New York Times reported that the revelations began with a routine tax inquiry by revenue agents, quote, conducting a routine examination of suspicious financial transactions reported to them by banks. This investigation allegedly found, quote, several unusual movements of cash involving the governor of New York, unquote. But the movement of the amounts of cash required to pay prostitutes, even high-priced prostitutes over a long period of time, does not commonly generate a full-scale investigation, unquote. We are talking about thousands, not millions of dollars. We are also talking about a man who was a multimillionaire with numerous investments and purchases, he added. Again, quoting, the idea that federal investigators would focus on a few transactions to corporations that were not themselves under investigation raises as many questions as answers. Yes, indeed, it does. So did Elliot Spitzer get stoned, so to speak? Was he the victim of some chicanery by Roger Stone? That certainly seems interesting. And also one wonders what else Roger Stone might have up his sleeve. Another interesting thing concerns one of Elliot Spitzer's allies, and this, let's just say with friends like this, who needs enemies? And that was a guy who played a key role in helping in being, shall we say, less than vigorous with regard to investigations of September 11th. At some point, we're going to tackle this guy in and of himself. It's a guy named Dietrich Dieter Snell. It's a nice Anglo-Saxon name, blonde hair, blue eyes, fair complexion. One wonders about his background. One of the things I've noted in the past in connection with not only the importation of Nazi war criminals to serve in the intelligence system, but the importation of Nazis, including SS men, to serve in the Republican Party, what did their children do? What do you think the children of the SS were counseled to do by their parents? Do you think their fathers, their SS fathers, counseled them to set up a floating Mahjong tournament? Perhaps. But I wouldn't bet on that. And again, I just wonder about Dietrich Dieter Snell. That's a nice Anglo-Saxon name. And as I've pointed out in the past, the Bush administration, in my considered opinion, is a front for the underground Reich and the Bormann Capital Network in particular. Literally a Third Reich gone underground and perpetuated in mafia-like style because of its political connections, which are derivative of its economic connections and economic power, which are consummate and go to the very core of the international cartel system. Dietrich Snell has proved less than vigorous in some of his capacities as a prosecutor, and in particular, he was a key element involved with the, quote, investigation, unquote, of September 11th, and we'll talk about that at greater length in the description. But I want to note here that in another Raw Story blog piece there, that Elliot Spitzer had Dietrich Snell as an ally, and I wonder if Dietrich Snell is truly an ally, or was Dietrich Snell actually a wolf in sheep's clothing, or perhaps a werewolf, the werewolves being the German youth guerrillas at the end of World War II who fought against the Allies. In any event, yet another Raw story from March 18th of 2008, this one by Peter Lance. Spitzer's mouthpiece has his own secrets to hide. As the sex scandal hurricane engulfed Elliot Spitzer last week, one of his closest advisors at the eye of the storm was Dietrich Dieter Snell. An ex-U.S. attorney from the same office conducting the prostitution probe, Snell is now defending Spitzer in the Troopergate scandal and reportedly raking in hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees for the international law firm he joined last year. A former Southern District prosecutor who later became senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, Snell is also one of the ex-feds who rewrote history on the commission's final report by relying entirely on the tortured confession, unquote, of 9/11's purported mastermind, unquote, to pinpoint the origin of the planes as missiles plot. He's the same, meaning Snell, he's the same investigator who dismissed as not sufficiently credible, unquote, the testimony of a decorated Navy captain who was part of a secret data mining operation that uncovered evidence of 9/11 hijackers in the U.S. more than a year before the attacks. A former deputy attorney general under the Sheriff of Wall Street, unquote, that's Spitzer, Snell is now attempting to quash the subpoenas of investigators probing whether Spitzer misused state troopers to investigate his chief political rival, protecting his ex-boss and mentor with a separation of powers defense worthy of Dick Cheney. Despite Spitzer's sudden flameout, there are currently three separate probes pending of Troopergate, the scandal that erupted when Spitzer's aides reportedly used state police to investigate the travel expenses of Senate Majority Leader Joseph L. Bruno. And more will be available. This entire piece will be available in the FTR supplemental section. So one wonders about Dietrich Snell, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. Is he really a good friend of Elliot Spitzer, or is he a wolf schanze in sheep's clothing, so to speak? Again, one can only wonder. Somebody who pretty much summed up some of my feelings on the subject was Chan Akaya, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation. That's an individual who writes for the Asia Times, a respected English language daily out of Hong Kong. And Chan Akaya had an interesting article about the dismissal, about the demise of Elliot Spitzer in the Asia Times. It's called Forget Spitzer, Fire Bernanke. And it reads, "There must be something about men achieving power that exposes them to frequent misuses of authority. In particular, infidelity seems a particular curse for the powerful across the world. This week's events involving the governor of New York, Elliot Spitzer, may, however, have helped to hide a more egregious misuse of authority, namely that of Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke and his central banking cohorts around the world. In another one of those nice coincidences that seem to happen whenever Wall Street is down and out, the unpopular governor of New York was found consorting with prostitutes through a federal investigation that has all the hallmarks of a hit job ordered from the very top. Spitzer was deeply unpopular in the corridors of power, and especially with the current Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, for daring to take various Wall Street firms down a few notches earlier this decade. After also hitting other sacred cows such as large insurance companies, Spitzer was readying ammunition to strike at the heart of the current subprime crisis by attacking the monoline insurers and rating agencies. It's almost too convenient that the disclosures of his extracurricular activities came this week. Still, let us take everything said at face value and not attempt to conjecture any conspiracy behind all this. People in Europe and Asia always find curious the preoccupation of Americans with sex, especially as the country appears to look askance at acts of immeasurable violence. This has been the formula for Hollywood. Nary a nipple in sight, but more than a few torsos getting blown to smithereens. Be that as it may, the focus of the Spitzer case on two separate legal areas, namely using a prostitute and secondly for potential money laundering, both appear strangely exaggerated in the rest of the world. Strangely exaggerated to the rest of the world. So the guy was having sex with a hooker. That's essentially a problem between the married couple rather than being the subject of intense public debate. Spitzer is said to have been neither crooked nor incompetent. If anything, his personal use of prostitutes may have contradicted his public crusade against brothels and pimps. In essence, Spitzer had to resign because he was a hypocrite. Reading that line, perhaps a few of you would wonder, as I did, about the implications of other politicians around the world being asked to resign for being hypocritical. Nope, I couldn't think of anyone who'd survive that either. The sorry state of the governor and his extramarital affair, though, helped to achieve something much more important, namely to hide a brewing problem in the securities industry. On Monday, when the Federal Reserve announced a new facility to help banks finance themselves by posting previously unacceptable collateral, stock and credit markets jumped for joy. That is, until someone started asking slightly cute questions on the lines of just who was in so much trouble that the Fed had to rush in through an ill-prepared intervention. With the Sherlock Holmes dictum of who benefits from the crime, it is clear that this week's moves were intended to help beleaguered brokers. While it is perhaps impossible to speculate just which company is in most trouble because of poor disclosure and the use of opaque valuation techniques, the most important brokers whose failure would have systemic implications include the likes of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. Coming as it does so close to the expected announcement of first quarter earnings, most brokers close their financial year in November, hence their first quarter ends February, the fear being expressed on the street was that it had to be one of the bigger firms, as otherwise the Fed would not have bothered. Brokers hold billions of dollars in the very securities that are suddenly eligible for refinancing with the Fed, such as mortgages and other securities that have proven well-nigh impossible to sell to investors for the past few months. This has split over into the rest of the financial system, hurting various cities and towns across the U.S. as they try to refinance themselves. That, in turn, must have gotten the government and its central bank all hot under the collar. At this stage, perhaps, readers will be wondering why I implied a crime had taken place on Wall Street, when all that seems to have happened is that a central banker has tried quietly to save one of the large financial firms in its backyard. The answer is a little more complicated than that, and touches upon the curiously ignored principles of central banking. Walter Bageot, B-A-G-E-H-O-T, and I may not be pronouncing that name right, the patron saint of central bankers, suggested the following basic principles for central banks to help the banks under their supervision to avoid liquidity runs. A, only lend against good collateral to avoid losses for taxpayers at a later date. B, lend at extremely high interest rates to avoid the facility being used willy-nilly by greedy bankers. C, make public the availability of such facilities so as to prevent doubts and suspicions in the minds of depositors and other creditors. This week's announcement by the Fed violates every one of those principles. Firstly, the collateral being accepted by the Fed is tainted as the market's complete lack of appetite at any price for the securities shows. By providing the ability to liquefy these securities, the Fed has effectively signaled that it would accept just about any junk. Secondly, the cost of borrowing is not punitive. Indeed, it is agreeably low for anyone who cares to fill out a couple of forms. Thirdly, this facility was not used previously, therefore the market has been in some doubt about how really useful it could be. In essence, this is a $200 billion facility that is being misapplied to rescue a specific part of the financial system at a preferential rate and without any disclosure required on usage. Given all this, it is impossible for anyone to expect that the ultimate cost of this facility would not be borne by U.S. taxpayers. In my last article on Europe, Eurotrash, Asia Times Online of March 11, 2008, I pointed to the failures of the European Central Bank, which similarly violated the Bageot principles when widening the range of acceptable collateral and lowering the discount rate made available to banks at the refinancing window. The Fed has entered into an arrangement that is eerily similar to that of the European Central Bank, whose actions have resulted in parts of the European financial system essentially becoming zombie, unquote, companies, i.e. dead, but still walking around. From where I sit, it appears that Bernanke has opened a whole new can of worms in his effort at maintaining the structural integrity of the U.S. financial system. The financial means used are clearly at odds with what Americans have preached to the rest of the world, including Asia, following its 1997 crisis. To that extent, it is clear that Bernanke suffers from a similar complex to Spitzer, i.e. that rules do not apply to them because of magical exclusions that are self-derived. Once we decide that both have committed acts that are essentially illegal, it then becomes a question of gauging just who committed the worst crime. Spitzer, through his actions, hurt his family and a small band of friends very badly. That, however, pales in comparison to the wide-ranging systemic damage being wrought by Bernanke through his ill-considered actions. The wrong government official resigned this week. Yes, indeedy. And very quickly, we're going to conclude with a column by Paul Krugman, the esteemed economist and one of the very few columnists with the New York Times or any place else willing to take it like it is. And this past Friday on the vernal equinox, March 21st of 2008, Paul Krugman had a column titled "Partying Like It's 1929." If Ben Bernanke manages to save the financial system from collapse, he will rightly be praised for his heroic efforts. But what we should be asking is, how did we get here? Why does the financial system need salvation? Why do mild-mannered economists have to become superheroes? The answer at a fundamental level is that we're paying the price for willful amnesia. We chose to forget what happened in the 1930s, and having refused to learn from history, we're repeating it. Contrary to popular belief, the stock market crash of 1929 wasn't the defining moment of the Great Depression. What turned an ordinary recession into a civilization-threatening slump was the wave of bank runs that swept across America in 1930 and 1931. This banking crisis of the 1930s showed that unregulated, unsupervised financial markets can all too easily suffer catastrophic failure. As the decades passed, however, that lesson was forgotten, and now we're relearning it the hard way. To grasp the problem, you need to understand what banks do. Banks exist because they help reconcile the conflicting desires of savers and borrowers. Savers want freedom, access to their money on short notice. Borrowers want commitment. They don't want to risk facing sudden demands for repayment. Normally, banks satisfy both desires. Depositors have access to their funds whenever they want, yet most of the money placed in a bank's care is used to make long-term loans. The reason this works is that withdrawals are usually more or less matched by new deposits, so that a bank only needs a modest cash reserve to make good on its promises. But sometimes, often based on nothing more than a rumor, banks face runs in which many people try to withdraw their money at the same time, and a bank that faces a run by depositors lacking the cash to meet their demands may go bust even if the rumor was false. Worse yet, bank runs can be contagious. If depositors at one bank lose their money, depositors at other banks are likely to get nervous too, setting off a chain reaction. And there can be wider economic effects. As the surviving banks try to raise cash by calling in loans, there can be a vicious circle in which bank runs cause a credit crunch, which leads to more business failures, which leads to more financial troubles at banks, and so on. That, in brief, is what happened in 1930 and 1931, making the Great Depression the disaster it was. So Congress tried to make sure that it would never happen again by creating a system of regulations and guarantees that provided a safety net for the financial system. And we all lived happily for a while, but not forever after. Wall Street chafed at regulations that limited risk, but also limited potential profits. And little by little it wriggled free, partly by persuading politicians to relax the rules, but mainly by creating a shadow banking system that relied on complex financial arrangements to bypass regulations designed to ensure that banking was safe. For example, in the old system, savers had federally insured deposits in tightly regulated savings banks, and banks used that money to make home loans. Over time, however, this was partly replaced by a system in which savers put their money in funds that bought asset-backed commercial paper from special investment vehicles, that bought collateralized debt obligations created from securitized mortgages, with nary a regulator in sight. As the years went by, the shadow banking system took over more and more of the banking business because the unregulated players in this system seemed to offer better deals than conventional banks. Meanwhile, those who worried about the fact that this brave new world of finance lacked a safety net were dismissed as hopelessly old-fashioned. In fact, however, we were partying like it was 1929, and now it's 1930. The financial crisis currently underway is basically an updated version of the wave of bank runs that swept the nation three generations ago. People aren't pulling cash out of banks to put it in their mattresses, but they're doing the modern equivalent, pulling their money out of the shadow banking system and putting it into treasury bills. And the result now, as then, is a vicious circle of financial contraction. Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues at the Fed are doing all they can to end that vicious circle. We can only hope they succeed. Otherwise, the next few years will be very unpleasant. Not another Great Depression, hopefully, but surely the worst slump we've seen in decades. Even if Mr. Bernanke pulls it off, however, this is no way to run an economy. It's time to relearn the lessons of the 1930s and get the financial system back under control. Of course, it was the collapse of the German economy and also the hyperinflation experienced by the German people in the 1920s that drove the German people into the arms of Adolf Hitler. One can only wonder what might happen here. And are we headed for something very similar? Certainly, lowering interest rates in the face of inflation, which is what Bernanke is doing, doesn't augur well. And I also think about the end of the book All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. That's available for download on the Spitfire website, where he notes that the people who frustrated the decartelization of Germany and the denazification of Germany, as he noted, the lesson is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are people in our own country who can make Germany a menace. More importantly, they could create a crisis of their own here at home, not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. And the men who would do this would not be Nazis, but businessmen, not criminals, but honorable men, unquote. This concludes For the Record program number 630, Partying Like It's 1929. This has been recorded on March 23rd of 2008. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.